Welcome to WisePod. Andalusia Farm, the home of Flannery O'Connor, is pleased to connect you with all manner of business happening here. As Flannery said, you can get to Milledgeville by bus and buzzard. And now, via WisePod. Enjoy.
Well, first off, good afternoon. Welcome to Andalusia's February 4. It's, I think, our 10th annual by this point. And of course, this is the second installment this year. We have two more Sundays coming up. So obviously, we've got a packed house. So if you're coming any of the next upcoming Sundays, definitely get here early and save your seats. I'm the Operations and Visitors Services Manager here. My name is April. Of course, this is the Flannery O'Connor Andalusia Foundation. We are a nonprofit organization that is charged with caring for preserving and caring for the 544 acres that Flannery O'Connor's farm is situated on. And it's where she wrote the majority of her work in the last years of her life, just over 10 years she spent here. And in addition to the work we do to preserve and restore, we also work with a number of artists, authors, writers, and even musicians on occasion, chefs on occasion. And we use their creativities and their ideas essentially to supplement what we do here by kind of digging into what inspired Flannery and to explore other aspects of Flannery and her life here. But I am absolutely pleased to introduce both of our speakers today. Dr. Bruce Gentry here. He is a professor of English over at Georgia College and State University. He is an O'Connor scholar, and he's actually teaching a class on O'Connor this semester at the school. And then Dr. Mab Sechrist, she's got a very interesting background, which she'll delve into a little bit. She's working with all sorts of interdisciplinary. She works in psychology, and she's currently looking into the history of Central State Hospital. So that'll help to inform our discussion today as well. And she is actually the newly appointed Martha Daniel Newell Visiting Distinguished Scholar at Georgia College this semester as well. So she's teaching a class over at Georgia College on Milledgeville and the Mind. So I'm excited about that class. We are going to be talking today about both Flannery O'Connor and Pete Dexter, who both wrote about Milledgeville's Steinbridge murders. And we're delving into how each of these authors approached this story and how they used it in their fiction. So there will be a brief Q&A afterwards, and we hope you'll stick around for some snacks. And I will pass it along to Dr. Gentry.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, and happy to be here with Bruce. I'm here as a Martha Daniel Newell Scholar, and I'm bringing my 10-year study of Central State Hospital to campus, and I'm writing a book about it. This is my fourth event this week, and a series called Jim Crow Sanity in question mark and quotations at the movies. Four films that either are set during the 1950s or reflect back onto the 1950s. Okay, we have three books, two people, and one microphone, so, so this is the last one of those. When I was trying to figure for a title to frame these events from the 50s, because they're really the apogee in terms of numbers of Central State Hospital, and they're the nadir, I think, in terms of patient experiences there, as they were all across the country. So Jim Crow Sanity was what I came up with, and it's got a question mark, or it's got quotes around it, because I really am putting in question what sanity can be in a Jim Crow era, that in retrospect, the values of which have been challenged substantially. So how does a state like Georgia or Alabama or any state decide who is crazy and who is not, when the system itself for deciding that, as we realize now, was so unjust, misformed, and somewhat delusional? So that's the general question that I've wanted to raise. And I do feel like this Stembridge material, as it's explored in its fullness by Pete Dexter, who's restored to us the whole story, really gets at those questions of individual and group consciousness and the way that they interact with each other in a really penetrating way. So that and Flannery O'Connor, who's writing the Partridge Festival based on the Stembridge murders, two very different versions of that, I think will give us lots of room for conversation about Jim Crow, the 50s, Flannery O'Connor here at Andalusia. Bruce. Hello.
Oh, I'm
glad
thought,
to be here.
I thought we would start with reality, get that out of the way quickly, and then move on to all of these artistic representations.
I'm looking.
We have a handout about a Macon Telegraph review of the situation. And here's a second handout.
Right.
Going
so, and there's Bruce and I both did charts. Since we have two books based on the Stembridge murders, actual events, for my chart there are three columns. And I was doing this as late as noon today. It's my kind of cheat sheet, but also to make clear what we know, what we don't know, and then what each author was doing with the material. I found one article that I passed around, and more recently I found an article kind of summarizing periodically. Local papers go back and review the Stembridge murders. They're quite sensational. From the Macon Telegraph, I think it is, in May, on murder in Milledgeville. So between these two, I have a certain amount of a chronology. The Marion Stembridge's rampage through over 5 years and killing four people plus himself starts in 1949. It's pretty established he was a loan shark, had a legitimate business too, but sold things like cars, high interest loans to poor people with a good bit of force at his disposal should they not come through with the money. So a young black man whose real name was John Cooper buys a car from him. He also buys at fairly exorbitant rates, insurance as well. Cooper is out on his first ride or out on a ride, has an accident, and realizes that he has insurance. So he goes to Stembridge to ask that the insurance pay for the wreck, and Stembridge says no, and so he leaves the car there and goes back to his home in the black community. Shantytown is one thing it's called in one of the accounts. This infuriates Stembridge, so he gets his assistant, and they go out to this black family's house, and they proceed, like Henry runs. John Cooper runs. So there are two black women on the porch. He proceeds to beat them with brass knuckles. The women run into the house. He follows them in the house, he and this other man, and they shoot each one three times. Kill one of them, seriously wound the other. He's arrested by the sheriff. I think his name is Sheriff Ennis. And he goes to trial, which I think is quite remarkable in a way. It shows that the mores are shifting in the South in Georgia, and that much to Stembridge's surprise, I think, that you can be held accountable for killing a black person. He is, in fact, convicted of manslaughter, right, and he's sentenced to 1 to 3 years. He appeals this. One of his lawyers is Marion Ennis, who during the course of the trial became increasingly discomforted about what he was defending. Stembridge appeals both to the Georgia Supreme Court, which upholds Baldwin County's conviction, and then to the Supreme Court, which also upholds Baldwin County's conviction. So he's on his way to jail when a local Superior Court judge stays the conviction and calls for another trial because of the claim that there had been perjury in the original trial. So Marion Stembridge never serves a day in his life in prison for the homicide and the attacks. And Ennis is more and more wanting to try to bring him to justice. He's gone from the defense side to the wanting him prosecuted side. In the meantime, federal authorities find information on tax evasion, so he's tried and convicted of federal crimes, and Stembridge is a suspect of Ennis and Bevins, that they have helped him. Also, apparently, Bevins helped Stembridge's wife get a divorce. So on the 150th anniversary of Milledgeville's founding as a state capital, he goes into two law offices and shoots both men. He shoots Ennis first in his law office, which I think was near what's now the Black Box Theater. He goes around to Sanford House, I'm not sure where that is, and shoots Bevins. And then he shoots himself and kills himself. So the fact that two such fine young lawyers had been killed was quite an uproar, and it eventually led the Macon newspaper to go back and find the backstory about the two women, these two black women, one of whom was killed by Stembridge, to put the whole thing together. So as much as I've been able to assemble it, that's the narrative. I have on the back of the chart that I gave you some of the quotations from the Macon newspaper. The Union Recorder said soon he was protected and defended by and relieved of his previous crimes by lawyers, a court, and a judge of our state. Or I think Macon newspaper, the first crime was a little thing. It was said he killed a Negro woman. He was convicted by a jury, and yet he never served a day for the dastardly crime, and he lived to enact the major assassination that took the life of two fine young men. So that's, as I say, as much as I've been able to reassemble. There are five folders on Marion Stembridge in the Georgia collection, the archives collection at Georgia College. So I'll be looking into those this semester, and those of you who are interested in the details of this, that's a good place to go. Okay, Bruce, so there's reality.
I can add a couple of details. These might be a little speculative. Apparently, people had looked at Marion Stembridge in earlier years and said, this person has severe problems. I ran across something that suggested that he had PTSD from World War I years, and that even before that, his relatives had tried to get him committed to the Central State Hospital, but apparently that never happened. And another delicious detail that I ran across that nobody used in the fictional treatments was that the sesquicentennial celebration was to start, Milledgeville's celebration of its founding was to start with the grand ball at Central State Hospital. And why didn't they use that? Okay, and now we'll plunge into Pete Dexter and all the complications of that, the movie version and the novel.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
I think what you've got Sheriff Ennis on here, I believe it's Sheriff Ellis.
Okay, good.
I think it's Ellis.
Okay, good. Ellis, yeah. Okay. Right. That's why it's good to have people.
That Ennis was the lawyer.
Ellis. Good, Sheriff Ellis.
Ellis was the chief of police.
Maybe the chief of police.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cox was the sheriff.
Okay, good. Good. Filling in these details.
Is where Bivens was killed? Is this the Sanford building? Was that the Sanford house that you
see
on that?
Yes.
The
house that was moved. Another delicious detail.
Other details, though, about Stembridge's mental state, which there were a good bit in retrospect. When police went to his room, which was in the Baldwin Hotel, the movie shows him in his house and his wife, Hannah, going to a hotel to stay. It was an arsenal. It was really chock full of weapons and ammunition, and he was ready to go with that. And he also had a padlock refrigerator. He was very paranoid. He was a paranoid man. He was very paranoid about getting getting poisoned. Apparently, there had been a big case in Macon about a woman who had poisoned a bunch of people. We talked about that earlier, right? So that was on his mind. He didn't want to eat any food put in front of him. He was only, by the end, eating canned food, and he had it locked in his refrigerator. Folks in the Macon article said that people only in retrospect realized he was not only odd but truly insane. And in the aftermath, people realized he was mentally sick but so shrewd he kept out of the mental institution, and said that he came from a well-established family in town, so no one questioned his bizarre behavior. So this is one of Jim Crow. What sanity? How do you get to call it? Who calls it? And then what's the repercussions?
Mm-hmm. So what's your take on what Pete Dexter did to the truth?
Well, it seems to me that he tracked it. He tracked it pretty carefully, as my chart shows, up to the point where Stembridge gets a retrial, where Paris Trout gets a retrial because of a bribe, it seems like, and the sheriff's going to take him away, or the police, who is going to take him away to prison, and then he doesn't get there. I think that what Paris Trout takes liberties on is the story of Hannah Trout, his wife, where there's a whole parallel story where he is also quite violent and controlling to her, according to the movie anyway. They'd been married 2 years. He had peculiar behavior. She would cook for him, and he would not want to eat it. He would make her eat both. And she was also quite sympathetic to black people in the town, to the character in the movie Rosie, the 12-year-old, not 18-year-old, who is killed by the combination of men. She went to the funeral, and he gets increasingly furious at her about that. He attempts to drown her. He rapes her brutally in his store, and she eventually leaves. Harry Seagraves, who is the Ennis character, who is this white Southern lawyer, white man, who in the process of the trial is increasingly unsettled about exactly what it is he's defending, the kind of things that he hears Paris Trout say that are so patently racist and also bizarre and just not making a lot of sense, except with certain narratives about Southern history, and he falls in love with Hannah Trout. So Seagraves there gets the backstory on Paris Trout, including finally Hannah tells him all the things Paris has done, including most recently when the lawyer Seagraves walks in on it, and he's thrown a lot of glass jars out of the refrigerator. They're all on the kitchen floor, and Hannah is there in barefoot, and she cuts her feet very seriously. He storms off. The lawyer comes in. He says, "Oh my goodness, you're under a lot of pressure to have done all this," and she says, "Paris did this." And then she tells him everything Paris has done. And he has to go to court the next day and defend Paris by trying to undermine the testimony of the witnesses who were on the porch, the family members of the girl who was killed. And he needs to do it by undermining them, questioning their credibility. And this young man says, "Our life changed." And he said, "Well, what about your life was so bucolic? I mean, what changed in your life?" He's really bullying him. And the young man says, "Rosa's life changed." And she died. I mean, so these witnesses, the black family, are really telling the truth in a very fraught situation, not so much like Emmett Till's family in Mississippi in 1954 and 55 will also tell the truth and point the finger at the people who lynched Emmett. So this movie, I think, shows that aspect and that moment in Southern history where there is an actual confrontation in court, where people are being brought to trial, and where he's eventually convicted, which in the movie he thought he never would. But the young prosecuting attorney in the office says to him, "We don't have two law codes in Georgia. We have one law code." And he said, "What do you mean you don't have two law codes?" Because you always had white law and then the law for black people. So there's a different standard afoot here. And I think that Mr. Ennis is quite, as Pete Dexter does, is quite an admirable character. I mean, it's interesting that this goes as the Stembridge murders, but the people who got murdered are also quite, or much more they deserve the story too, and I think that's what Dexter's trying to do. But I do think that he's probably pulled all of this love interest in there. I don't know. Y'all would know that more than me, but it does seem like a kind of Hollywood thing. And I do think if the story is just about the public sphere and court and law, because at the end, Stembridge kills the Ennis character, Harry, because in Hannah's bedroom, where he also shoots his mother, whom he's carried there. So he's going to shoot the two women in the domestic sphere, but actually, no, he goes to law offices and he shoots the white men lawyers who haven't been on his side, you know, and they die. And Ennis is this person who has really gone through this transformation like many Southerners did and would in the 50s and 60s. Where he's had to look at something, and his positionality, his conscience, and his actions have shifted, and he pays a price for it. So to me, that's in the aggregate what I see Pete Dexter doing, and then what he's kind of inventing. And I kind of myself like that public narrative. Although I appreciate, as a woman and a feminist, he really brings in domestic violence in a huge way. And it's my experience that the men who were being violent in the public sphere were not being tender sweethearts at home. But he does elaborate on that. So what did...
Okay. My take on the novel is that the black characters are the moral center, and that... Pete Dexter is being totally judgmental of all the white people in town because they do know what they're dealing with in Paris Trout, and they do nothing to stop him, and they do nothing to stop him, and they do nothing to stop him, and he's like a runaway train. And the book is very judgmental. In that regard, the Central State Hospital has almost no presence in the novel or the book, but I think at some point you're supposed to figure out that one of the things that the town could have done was to put this person away, that some kind of control needs to be, you know, put on him. And if it's not going to be a prison, it needs to be an asylum. And it's kind of the fact that Central State Hospital doesn't come up more in the novel is, you know, an indication that nobody thinks that they could send this white man to the prison. When Dexter goes from novel to movie, he wrote the screenplay. He simplifies a lot. He makes the black characters even more the moral center, I would say. There might be other opinions about this in the room. And he makes mothers much more important in a way that's rather mysterious to me. I mean, how are we supposed to feel about Paris Trout's mother? Did she make him what he is? You know, this horrible, horrible, horrible person. Okay, so that's my take on that. And then the question I thought we were going to have to answer today, uh-huh. You know, the quiz uh-huh. question was going to be, so is it sin or insanity? And my answer with Pete Dexter is that he can't decide, and it's both. He wants to blame everybody. He thinks that Paris Trout is totally insane, but he is not going to let Paris Trout off the hook one bit. You know, the insanity defense is not going to do Paris Trout any good in the courtroom run by Pete Dexter.
The sin or insanity question, in some ways, I realized, I have to admit, was a little misframed in terms of these two in this O'Connor story. If you take the misfit, which is in...
Wait a minute, we're still talking about Pete.
Yeah. There's a different thing that happens there. So let's just go back, though, to the moral center of the story. I have no problem with the moral center of the story being black people. Because I think the moral center in most in the South in the 50s and 60s with the civil rights movement was in the black community. I grew up in a white community in Tuskegee in Alabama, and I learned pretty rapidly, although I was afraid to say it, that my community was frighteningly off base. And I learned eventually over time to understand the kind of moral, spiritual, and ethical challenges being raised on the other side. So even though a movie and a book will truncate things, I found quite convincing the black mother and the black family on the porch. And I found quite convincing the fact that these fine young white lawyers wouldn't have been killed if anybody had cared about the black woman who had gotten shot before. Attorney Ennis did, and he was killed. But there was and this is my opinion. You know, we all have opinions, and we all hear them. But that it's also being said by the paper, though. Like, we really let this sleep. He was even convicted, which is good, but he never served a day. Even though the Supreme Court found him guilty, he never served a day. So what Dexter does is go back and put those pieces of the story together, which O'Connor does not. I mean, we can move on maybe to O'Connor now, but she has the murder from the Stembridge murders. It's the Azalea Festival and 150 years of Milledgeville is the capital. But it's not the attack on a black family and the homicide of a black woman that's the backstory for that. It's the fact that Singleton, is the name she gives to the Stembridge character, was humiliated by the town fathers because he didn't wear a badge in the Azalea Festival. And so he's put in stocks and he's tried and sentenced in a privy with a goat. So he's so humiliated by this that he comes back and opens fire on the celebration and the city fathers. He kills five of them and accidentally shoots a civilian, I guess you would say, or somebody in the audience when the mayor leans down and the bullet goes over. So the two young people who come to cover it, there's Calhoun and Mary Elizabeth, who separately are coming back to town and who are very disdainful of the culture in the town, and so who have construed Mr. Singleton as a kind of martyr and hero, and that he has been driven mad by the madness of the town. And so the Stembridge figure, Singleton, doesn't kill himself. She does put him out at the asylum, except it's Quincy State Hospital, 20 miles away. And so very shakily, Calhoun and Mary Elizabeth go to interview him, and they find not the insane hero romanticized that they expect, but this kind of crazy old white guy in his hospital robe running around and flashing and really being lecherous and coming on to her. And this really startles them, and it's so at odds with the image, the romanticized image they have of him, that they flee. And Calhoun realizes he really doesn't have it in him to be a writer. He needs to go back to selling things, which he was afraid that was his fate anyway. So it's quite remarkable to me that O'Connor inserts this highly trivialized backstory, this really atrocious set of murders, and then puts as the kind of reflective characters these two young people who are so clearly discredited at the end, when Mr. Calhoun could have been a young Pete Dexter. Here's this Pete Dexter who grows up in the community, who hears about this, who perhaps has heard some of these stories too, and goes back and puts the pieces together, however much he might elaborate, and then how much Hollywood elaborates on top of that. But O'Connor really does, I mean, the way she changes things, I think, is a kind of testimony to what she felt was important and to really discredit. I mean, it's a weird kind of displacement. Let me just stop there. And when you line her up to the history and then to Dexter, there's lots of gaps that she fills in different ways that, as I teach my students to say, problematic. When you want to be polite, say, I find that problematic.
This was built as a discussion.
Yeah.
well, why doesn't Flannery talk about the black folks? Because if she did, she would have to make Marion Stembridge into a symbol of total evil. I'm sorry. I think if she had talked about the black people who were killed, she would have had to make Marion Stembridge in the person of Singleton into a totally evil person the way Pete Dexter did. And she was up to something different, which is more about asylums than Pete Dexter's book is about asylums. Think about that. Okay. Nobody in the town understands Singleton. The two writers who want to romanticize everything and make him wonderful, they don't get it. They don't get Singleton. The people in the town who are interviewed by Calhoun through most of the story, they have a variety of opinions about Singleton, none of which they really acted on in time. There is that kind of judgment, you know, like in the Pete Dexter novel, that nobody did anything. But they don't agree with each other, and they don't really see Singleton either. I think that in the O'Connor story, the killer is more of a mystery. Have I ever heard that word before in relation to Flannery O'Connor? That Singleton is more of a mystery than Paris Trout is in the novel Paris Trout. We've got that sucker at the end of that novel, and we know what things drove him to do evil, horrible, crazy things, and we've got him in a way that I think we don't in the little O'Connor story. Let's think about the feminist side to these two texts while we're at it. Seagraves, the lawyer, and Hannah Trout have an affair. And there are parts of the novel where a reader gets really caught up in wanting them to have a great affair and, you know, wanting them to have a good time and rooting for them in a way, personal opinion here. but Seagraves never makes the right choices. He continues to let Paris Trout be Paris Trout. And there are scenes here and there where Hannah fails, like lots of women in similar situations, to be able to cut herself off. And one of the climactic scenes towards the end of the novel is Seagraves watching Hannah, watching the humiliation of Paris Trout, and he realizes that she still loves him. She still loves that monster. And I think Pete Dexter is being judgmental of everybody at that point in a way that maybe Flannery isn't. Another thing I want to point out about the Flannery O'Connor story, because people have been making me reread the end of that story fairly recently and carefully. What happens at the end is quite different for the two main characters of that story. Calhoun, as you said, realizes that he needs to be a salesman. What is going on with Mary Elizabeth? Something entirely different, okay? On about halfway down the next to last page, the two writers go into the room at the asylum where they're going to have their interview with Singleton. He comes in, and there are about five or six lines where he's insulting Calhoun. And then he forgets about the man. He turns to the woman, and he sexually harasses her, tries to rape her. He terrifies her with a sexual attack. And that goes on about six times as long as his attack on Calhoun. They run from the room. Calhoun and Mary Elizabeth are sitting in the car at the end, and they are both having recognition scenes, as you would expect at the end of the Flannery O'Connor character. Calhoun's is that he needs to be a salesman. And he looks into Mary Elizabeth's eyes. He looks into her glasses. And what does he see? Not her. He's not paying attention to the woman at the end of the story. He sees his own reflection in her eyeglasses and decides that this is his revelation, that he is really looking at his grandfather when he looks at himself. And so here's this lesson about being a salesman. We have to infer, because the text doesn't tell us, what's this like for Mary Elizabeth? It's really bad. She's been trying to find a way out of her situation. And she's been putting up with jokes about what the community expects from her and what are her options in life. She has tried to find a way out. And I'm afraid what she's discovering at the end of it is that none of them will work. That she is stuck in a really bad place with no options and not even somebody in the car with her who will pay attention to her, her existence. The story is quite a tragedy for Mary Elizabeth. And, when I ponder Flannery's comment about her story, you know, that she wasn't happy with it, she took it out of her second collection because she thought it was too lightweight. I think we can refine that and say Flannery may have said to herself that she was bringing up issues that are really, really, really serious and not finishing the job. And to tell the full story about what a bad situation Mary Elizabeth is in at the end of this story is a chunk of the story that, you know, she didn't find a way to flesh out that part of the story. One of the things that pushed me in this particular direction and talking about the story this way was looking at the Driggers and Dunn book that talks about when Flannery wrote what, and it says that she was working on the Partridge Festival at the same time she was working on The Comforts of Home. The Comforts of Home is the story with Sarah Hamm in it, you know, the character who's kind of questionable sanity, perhaps. I mean, everybody's telling her that she's crazy, at least. And then I'm reminded of a comment that Flannery said one time about characters like Sarah Hamm being not really responsible for themselves, that when you write about them, what you're really talking about is everybody else's responsibility to take care of them and fix things for them. And I think, okay, maybe that's what we should read into the Partridge Festival. Not that Flannery is condemning people for doing sinful things, but condemning them for what they don't do, for all the sins of omission, for letting things get out of control the way they have, and leaving Singleton in his state, and making Mary Elizabeth at the end of that story look like the real odd man out. I mean, it seems to me she's the real single person who's in a stuck place at the end of that story. Flannery was thinking about turning the story into a love story, and she gave up. And even though the Comforts of Home, the story she was writing at the same time, talks about repressed passion between the male and female characters in that story, and I think she was trying to play with the same notion as she was writing the Partridge Festival, and she just kind of decided it wasn't working the way it would to be believable, and so she made it about something else. And I think, one way we can say the story succeeds is talking about the mystery behind what people think they have understood. And that is not so much in Calhoun, the main character, but I think in Mary Elizabeth and in the killer, who is I think, not understood by the writers and not understood by the town.
next. What else? Are we done?
I find that a sensitive and persuasive analysis of the story as it's written. You know, and the point I'm making a different point.
Fiction, nonfiction.
Well, no, I'm making a different point about the ways that different people write different things, and to me, the tragedy and the mystery out of the story is the fact that these black women were killed and one of them, I mean, were attacked and one of them died. I mean, when I think about a novel written from my home state of Alabama, it was published in 1960, it's Atticus Finch, who takes on a defense of a black man for rape in the 30s, but the sensibility is the 60s, but it's 50s, but it's a challenge to Jim Crow sanity. And what would have happened if somebody had shot Atticus? I mean, that's really the story of the lawyer. Would Scout ever even have been able to tell that story? But it's a very different set of questions. And I'm not expecting Flannery to have those questions. But I think that it is fair to kind of compare the range of Southern writers and Southern white women writers writing from small communities, Lillian Smith, for instance, also a Georgian, to assess the moral vision, which O'Connor tells us repeatedly is the core of her work. Mm-hmm. You know? So my own experience, born in 49 as a Southerner, is that the main moral issue in the South in the 50s and 60s was the question of race. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's my biography too. So anyway, but I think we've opened up enough, and many people in here have both more details, and I'm sure many opinions too. But
yeah, I'm ready to take notes on what y'all tell me.
Right. And for this is for the podcast. We'll try to repeat.
She was.
As O'Connor scholars, what do you know about Flannery O'Connor's attitudes towards race?
Oh, well, we can deal with that quickly. There are letters in which Flannery repeats racist jokes. Shame on her. I think in the fiction, she was consistently anti-racist, and that the issues of race come up a lot in a lot of stories. Not this one. I don't know why she didn't bring it up in this one, but you know, it does seem like it would be something interesting to see her talk about, you know, the fact that Singleton had killed a black person. That's the short answer, is that Flannery picked up more of the racism of her time and of her family than she realized, but she was conscious of it enough to consistently write stories exposing and ridiculing racist thought. And, you know, Lillian Smith did a better job of dealing with it. I mean, I look at what Carson McCullers did with you know, race in Georgia, and I think she was more upfront about saying some things that needed to be said than Flannery ever was. And you know, I know Craig Amison has, you know, who's taken over the Lillian Smith empire, you know, has said to me a couple of times that he thinks Lillian did the right thing in some ways that Flannery never quite did. I think he's right.
Do you see an influence of Flannery on Pete Dexter's work?
She made sure he wasn't going to be Calhoun.
Right. Right.
He wasn't going to idealize his killer.
Well, Pete Dexter would have. He was growing up in this.
Yeah, he was like 9 or something.
Yeah,
I guess,
yeah.
Each other.
No. But he would have, as a writer, he would have known Flannery, right, and I think he would have known Partridge Festival too. But he also found out the backstory. So I've never, but I haven't seen anything where he's deliberately talking about it. And I don't know if there's allusions or references. If they aren't, they aren't ones that I picked up. But you can be sure that a writer from Milledgeville writing after Flannery O'Connor has read Flannery O'Connor.
Mm-hmm. We're not discussing the film, which is unfortunate, but you'll very clearly see sin and insanity brought out through the performance of Dennis Hopper, through the mother in the opening, the wolf, the rabies, the shooting her at the end. So we really can't talk about it if you haven't seen the movie, but if you do.
Where would you say the sin is? I mean, there's the insanity. I mean, how would you see those going together?
In the movie?
Yeah.
I can only speak to the movie. Right?
Yeah. No, that's what I'm speaking to, too.
The sin, the sexual abuse of his wife, the sin of ignorance, the sin of not acknowledging some of the people in his town that obviously knew that things were not right. I think there's a real correlation about insanity with his mother in the beginning and then shooting her at the end out of sympathy, out of peace. Okay. But his mother influence was very strong all the way through the movie.
You think he kills her out of sympathy?
Yes, out of peace. The mother? Certainly, because he's so loving in the beginning. He's there in the rocking chair. He's trying to explain to her. And also, you have to look at Dennis Hopper's expressions, his eyes, his movement.
Right.
And if you know anything about Dennis Hopper's movies, you know he's excellent at being insane. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
and he also has a very influential, about the movie, about Peter Dexter wrote it, but Stephen Gyllenhaal directed it, but Dennis Hopper's acting in it. Mm-hmm. So.
I just thought he blamed his mother for everything, and he never took responsibility for anything he did.
Total responsibility for her, and he took her out at the end because he didn't want to do what he was going to do.
We should be on a panel, huh?
Well, but the point is, he killed himself after he killed his mother.
You know, I wouldn't have seen it. You know, the ethical questions you raise in terms of his activities towards his wife and the community, like, they're not cast in theological terms, though. I certainly would cast them in ethical terms. But the movie doesn't put those questions in kind of a church context or whatever. So I think that's what I meant. Yeah, right,
church.
Right, yeah.
Since I've had
but I do think they're ethical. Right,
production.
Absolutely, yeah. And this Edwin, Edwin Askins, for all the you radio people out there, who's just retired from being a Hollywood producer. So he's giving us his opinion.
I produced several, but I was at Paramount.
Yes, okay, Paramount, sorry.
But you said that historically, Barbara Hershey was not a beautiful character. That
she was beautiful.
Yes, but the character was rather plain, to say it nicely. You don't have Hollywood casting movies with plain people.
Right.
Barbara Hershey brought that box office to life. The sex scenes brought it to life.
Right.
Dennis's insanity brought it to life. And you can't be critical of Hollywood because that's what they're in the business to do, is to provide entertainment, make money, and to be as close to reality as possible. But they were buffered by Peter Dexter because they weren't going from the original historical facts to a movie. They were going off of Peter Dexter, so they can be a little less accurate.
It's versions of versions of versions.
Right.
Do you think the director changed Dexter's screenplay significantly?
Yeah. I've talked to the director about it. He did, under the auspices of Dennis Hopper. Never forget the power of Dennis Hopper and the craziness. You know, he, on his deathbed, he was trying to divorce his wife so she wouldn't get his art collection. On his deathbed, he's got a lawyer trying to get a divorce. If that doesn't speak to everything, I give up.
Any other question before we go to refreshments?
Does anyone know Vera Pete Puckett? Who is, I'm told, the historical figure who became the peg leg woman, Charlotte Hawke, in the novel, who's missing from the movie. Flannery at about this time was beginning to have the experiences that would result in her creation of Holga Joy Hopewell, the PhD with the woman with a wooden leg, in the story Good Country People. It's all about that same time. It's all in the blender. And I think someday I'm going to find somebody who knows Pete Puckett, and she'll tell me things. And did Flannery know her? And, you know, what's the story about women with artificial legs in Milledgeville in the early 50s?
Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming. We have refreshments. We can talk informally.